Yo. Can you hear me? You listening to
Hashtag WAW. What a week. What a week.
Eta, welcome to another edition of Wow, What a Week. I'm going to be starting a Legends series. Legends as in people that influenced my career path. People that when I was a teenager, I'd look at and say, wow, I want to do that one day. We're going to be starting that series, and we're starting it off with one of my favorite DJs. Coming up next.
Yo. Can you hear me? You listening to
Hashtag WAW. What a week.
What a week.
You know, I think because we're about to speak to one of my favorite DJs, it actually makes sense for us to talk about this quickly. Southern Comfort, some of us know it as SoCo, has teamed up with DJ Chaotic, one of my favorite DJs on the planet. One original spirit with another. If you know Southern Comfort, the smooth whiskey base with stone fruits and spices, you know you can mix it with just about anything. Lemonade, cola, orange juice. Yes, you can mix it. Now stand a chance to mix it up with your mates, because Southern Comfort is giving away a house party valued at 100,000 Rand with DJ Chaotic on the decks. It's about talking to your original spirit. Buy a bottle of Southern Comfort to enter. Details are in store. Southern Comfort, so tasteful, so original. Drink responsibly. Not for sale to people under the age of 18.
This is
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Celebrity guest.
Celebrity guest.
So what I've decided to do is I don't feel I interview enough people that have had a massive impact on my career. So I figured I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to be very intentional about it because I'm interviewing people that have had influences on other people's careers. But they're people who actually, I believe, were they not in my path on this journey I'm on, I don't know if things would be what they are right now. And one such person I've been a fan of since, I think I was 19, when I first heard of this white kid tearing up parties in townships. And as fate would have it, eventually I met him and we started associating. I'll give you guys a better story about how me and this gent became friends, acquaintances, and even business partners. Please make some noise and welcome the legendary. Yes, if you're in Malawi, legendary. Make some noise for the legendary DJ Christos Kasaitis. Chrissy,
Freshka.
What's up, brother, man?
Superman.
You know the one who calls me Freshka. Are you well?
I'm good, man.
Christos 101, where were you born and raised? Like, take us back to, like, the beginning.
Born in Joburg.
Yeah.
Raised in Joburg. I was raised all over, actually.
Okay.
But I was at boarding school, so it was in Joburg, you know. So I was in the streets of Joburg all my life.
Okay, so you were born to a Greek family.
Yeah.
So did your family settle here or were they also born here?
My parents actually came here. My dad got, he actually worked at Afrox when it first opened. So they brought him here specifically for that.
Yes, sir.
And then they decided to stay and we were born and lived here forever.
So who's we? How many siblings do you have?
One brother.
Okay.
An older brother.
And then where is he now?
He's here.
Yeah.
He's here and he's in the kind of electronic field.
Yes.
Yeah.
So growing up, I mean, tell us about like a typical growing up in the Katsaitis household.
Food and food and food, eh?
Yeah.
So a lot of good food.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so I have a very good palate, good taste buds.
Yes, sir.
A lot of food, very strict family, in a sense. So boarding school was great for us because we could do what we wanted.
So where did you go to boarding school?
Went to boarding school in Johannesburg.
Okay. Where? Which one?
It was kind of an underground boarding school.
Jeez. Okay. So you've been part of the underground forever.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where I come from. So don't blame me. So I actually went to Parktown Junior.
Okay.
As an English school, but then I went to a boarding school, which was called Protopapa.
Okay.
And that was kind of underground because it wasn't allowed, you weren't allowed to learn other, you know, languages and so forth.
Oh, so it was a non-African school.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I had to, you know, so I actually did double school all my life, you know.
Oh, wow.
I went to school during the day to the normal school, and then I went to school after school.
To the Greek school.
To the Greek school.
Oh, wow. So what were you taught to the Greek school that wasn't being taught in the normal curriculum?
It was pretty much everything. I think the difference was the maths was on a way higher level,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
You know, but you're taught everything, you know. It was like school again.
Sure.
You know.
But did you understand why you were going through that? Or did you feel like you're being punished?
I kind of understood it, but but I felt the punishment.
Okay, so pardon the stereotype, but your average Greek kid grows up in a family business that they take over. Mm-hmm. Was there a family business, and why did you not take it over?
There was, in a sense, even though my parents had a couple of businesses, a bit of this, a bit of that.
Yeah.
But I think they left due to my grandparents being ill.
Okay.
So they left like around about 86.
Jeez, okay.
You know, so we stayed, you know. So
how does music then get into the mix in terms of the career path you choose?
That's a good question. You look, I think we were kind of musical in our own sense. My parents love music, you know, and all forms of music and jazz. Like I said, just generally all forms of music. And funny enough, me and my brother just got into, I think, soul.
Yeah.
You know, soul, jazz, and I don't know, maybe it was in the genes, eh? You know, I think it was in the genes because, you know, I love music from young. And I didn't want toys. I wanted records.
Ah, yes.
That's what I wanted. And my parents would frustrate me and I wouldn't get them. Mm. And I actually landed up working at a record store at the age, it was like 12, 13.
Which record store was this?
Record World. It was actually in Pretoria.
Okay.
Because I do weekends.
Mm.
And I started first by making tea, cleaning up on Saturdays.
Yeah.
And eventually actually working in the store until I was 18 and selling music.
Oh, wow.
And they would specialize in jazz, imports, but of course, house as well. Well, let's just say disco music at the time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So how does the DJing start? And who are the influences at the time? I mean, who are the big names when you are growing up?
We didn't have any big names here. You know, so I was actually lucky that I could go to Greece age 16, 15, 16.
Yeah.
And I was just an avid, I loved the music.
Sure.
Never even thought of DJing because I didn't even know it was a career.
Absolutely.
You know, and I was actually at a hotel that we were staying at. It was a holiday hotel.
Yeah.
And there were DJs playing. And I thought to myself, that's what I want to be.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. And there was like a gig.
Sure.
And I could see it from my hotel room. Wasn't allowed to go in. And I said, you know, that's what I want to do. And immediately when I kind of got back, I started now trying to see how I can mix, you know, which was a mission.
Yes, sir. Yes,
from
sir.
Tapes, from cassettes to whatever, you know.
You just wanted to sound like the guys in Greece that you heard.
Yeah, yeah. And I even bought some of the records that I heard. You know, I could, you know, I remember a song called Heaven, you know. That I actually went out and searched for it and I bought it. And I think, you know, music was in me, you know.
If I'm not mistaken, though, your career didn't start on the so-called black scene. Or did it?
I know.
Yeah.
Let me say no, because where I was allowed to play, it wasn't necessarily...
Yeah.
It was not black. It was not the black scene.
Sure.
No, not at all. You know, so funny enough, though, one of my mentors was actually an African-American.
Okay.
And the first club that I worked in, because I entered a competition.
Yeah.
And I came second.
Sure.
It was actually a competition, believe it or not, with Ready D.
Oh, wow.
You know.
Do you know roughly what year this is?
87.
Jeez, okay.
87, 88.
Yeah.
And it was with Ready D, and I came second in that competition. And the club actually kind of employed me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, we can give you a job.
Yeah.
You know, and there was an African-American DJ, Jason James.
Yeah.
And he had a big influence on my career in the sense of, he taught me a lot of things. He taught me how to speak, how to compare, because being a DJ in those days, you kind of had to run
a
ladies' night.
You had to work the mic.
Yeah. You had to be able to DJ. You'd play 8-hour sets.
Yeah.
I mean, you play the whole night.
Yeah.
It's one resident. If the lighting guy can play a bit, he'll give you a break.
Sure.
You know what I mean? But that was it. Eh? You even run to the toilet.
So on ladies' night, you should be able to work the mic.
He must work the mic. Yeah, you have to work the mic.
So when did you start moving towards the township gigs and the township economy?
Kind of late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
From the club that I worked in Pretoria, because at that stage I was in Pretoria.
Sure.
I moved to Johannesburg, Caesars Palace, when they opened.
In fact, I was going to say, because you were at Caesars for a bit also.
When they opened. Yes. I was there for quite a while. So I'll do two nights at Caesars.
And Caesars was epic because all of your big internationals that came to South Africa, even if it was just a handful, they performed at Caesars.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember seeing I don't know if it was... Was it Technotronic or Black Box? I don't know if I saw a poster that they were going to be performing at Caesars late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
And it was, look, it was the club of the moment. I mean, technology, everything.
It had everything, yes.
Yeah, it had everything. And the only problem was the music that I was playing now.
Yes.
Because the music was soul, funk.
Yeah.
And I was attracting a different clientele, and I started to pick up a lot of problems because of that. So obviously now all these people were turning up, and as much as now we got to the 90s, so kind of the political parties were freed, people tried things, and I was actually let go because of that.
Oh,
it
wow.
was like, dude, no, you're bringing the people that are queuing up here are not for us. Either change the music or go.
Tell me you don't want my black crowd without telling me you want my black crowd.
Yeah, so I was kind of, you know, bye. You know, but I kind of knew in a way it's not where I wanted to be.
Sure.
You know, and immediately I kind of went to the township. You know, I got a job at in Klipgat at a club called Gemini.
Yes.
And in Tembisa at King's Palace. So I had those two residencies.
In fact, I always tell the story about how when I first heard about you and the legend of Chris, and I started appreciating what you do, twice on a Sunday, we stole the car from my dad and crossed the border into apartheid South Africa to listen to you play at Gemini.
Yeah.
Twice. I had no driver's license. It's apartheid South Africa. There was like 3-4 of us. None of us had licenses. But it was worth it, dude. We'd drive, we'd party, and then we'd make sure we're at the border at 6 in the morning when it opens on Monday. Drop my dad's car off, tell him we were studying the whole night. And life carried on. So I actually want to thank you for helping me break the law with your inspiration and just for being a beacon of light when we didn't have many beacons of light. Because for a lot of kids who wanted to be DJs, we didn't have many people to look to. So for me, I mean, I discovered you, and then I discovered Vinny, and then I discovered Oskido. And as fate would have it, before I knew it, we were in the same rooms.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank you for that, bro. And now I have a voice note for you. You'll tell us who this is after we play it.
Hey, Fresh. Yeah. I had a lot of memorable experiences with Chris. I mean, if I have to stack them up, I think the most memorable will be to have produced two albums with him, the Two DJs and the Keyboard Player albums, which was phenomenal. Nurturing Boom Shaka to the group that they became. You know, touring around the country with Chris was always a laugh. You know, I remember going on the Sony tour with him and driving in a Golf through the dongas of the Transkei. That was an experience and a half. I mean, it's like endless. I can write a whole book on this. Kudos to Chris. Great guy. Always loved him. Always will. Yeah, that's about it, man.
And then I have one more before you tell us who that was.
Oh, yeah. And I remember working on Sharon Dee's album, Song Kesi Aphila. That was a great experience. Also, Bob Mabena's producer's cut, Amaru. Fantastic experience that as well. And great memories sharing the stage with people like Trompies, Brenda Farsi, Ndu, Arthur, Mosquito. Man, those were good days, eh? Really good days.
Who is that and how did you meet this gent?
Static P.
Yeah.
Actually met Pedro in the club scene.
Okay.
I think before everything, everybody was trying to kind of do the underground thing or what everybody was doing internationally, these warehouse things or smaller parties.
Yeah.
I think we were on the same wavelength where we're not into this whole druggy thing or,
Were you just happy to see a fellow Greek dude playing in black clubs?
Actually, we didn't in the beginning. I mean, it just happened because once again, it was the music. You know, the music brings you together. It was just the type of music that we wanted to play. And
I, in a way,
I didn't have a place to play it at,
sure. You
know?
Yeah.
Besides the club that I was at, but at the club that I was at, you also had to be careful. You had to be a bit poppy. The club, the technology was amazing. I mean, at that time we were mixing in videos.
Yeah.
We'd actually play a Michael Jackson video,
with the song.
The club
with
the song.
Yeah.
So the technology was quite hectic in the club, you know. So there was a lot of sensational things that you could do, but at the same time, there's a lot of music you couldn't play.
You weren't feeding your soul, basically.
Yeah. You know,
you and Pedro then do two DJs and a keyboard player. Tell us about the project and how it set the scene for the scene.
Yeah, actually, just the whole we started off and, you know, I was kind of at the time we were with Kalawa and we were working with Don, myself and Oscar.
Sure.
The only problem was that Don had a lot of things up his sleeve and Kalawa was just starting off or it just started off and we couldn't have access to the studio when we wanted to. I wanted to make music all the time. I mean, I had the time and I wanted to make music and me and Pedro kind of, he had a computer.
Sure.
I bought a keyboard and we started making music. And eventually two DJs and a keyboard player kicked off. It was the two of us and Reply as a keyboard player.
Yes.
And he was with me for a long time.
Mm.
And we did this project. And it was a project of samples that we actually had nabbed. And we kind of turned them around that nobody would recognize the samples. Besides Sekele.
Yes.
And Secular was a massive hit, and funny enough, the track was off key.
No, Secular was off key.
Yeah, it was off key. And we kind of knew that something was wrong, eh?
Yeah.
So this is what happens when you have non-musicians.
Yeah. You're like, it doesn't sound right, but it's got a groove, though.
Hey, it sounds right, you know? And you know, funny enough, I tried to re-release it fixed that it sounded wrong.
Yeah.
So it was one of those.
Sometimes the art is in the it not
being right,
not following the rules. Sometimes the rules don't make it nice.
Yeah, but I kind of think I learned a lot about that. And those albums did, that album went like quadruple platinum.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we started. We were selling the stuff ourselves. So we were printing the cassettes, selling it ourselves, and so it was good. It was kind of self entrepreneurship and building everything, and being honest, my studio got built through those two albums, you know.
In fact, the Kalawa model is part of what you employed in terms of marketing and selling two DJs and a keyboard player.
Yeah.
How did Kalawa happen? Because we've heard the story from everyone but you. How did you guys meet?
Actually met Oskiro because I used to be part of a record store.
Yes.
Which I started off with Tim, actually, at first.
This was
Tim White. This is called Megatrax. This is like late 80s.
This is at the bottom of Pretoria Street, no?
This was in Louis Botha.
No, man. Didn't I meet you guys before you moved to Louis Botha?
No. It was actually in Louis Botha.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was actually in Louis Botha. It's just that they moved a little bit further down later.
So whose store was that on Pretoria Street in Hillbrow? literally at the bottom near the hospital. There was a record shop in the corner there.
I think maybe Tim started off
in the beginning. Yes.
And then when we kind of rekindled the store, we actually moved to to Orange Grove in Lubuerta, you know. And obviously that brings a lot of people together because everybody would drive from all over, you know. And actually Buy Records met Oscar, became good friends. I even stayed at Oscar's house for a while, you know. And just being in the club scene, I mean, our life was the club scene, you know, and Oscar was playing in Hillbrow at Arena. And I think we both had this passion. We're very passionate South Africans in the sense that we have nothing of our own, man.
Yes.
You know what I mean? We got to start making music for ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know, and we thought, you know what, let's do something. We started at first with cover versions, trying to do cover versions of things we couldn't release or license in South Africa. And then...
Was that part of the Mix Master stuff and the other series that came out?
But, yeah, it was also...
By other people.
It was also like an influence in some of the songs we did. I mean, even the Kerata Baby that I did with Theo. Theo sang that. It was actually an international track that we turned into vernacular.
It was a rave song.
Yeah.
Called I Love You Baby.
Yeah. And we played it at half speed.
Yeah. Not even half. I think you reduced it like to a quarter speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of started there, you know, not knowing what we kind of had a vision.
Sure.
But not knowing where we're going, you know, let's just do something.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess it that's how Kalawa formed, you know, and we needed somebody. So we met with Don. Don had the studio.
Yeah.
And we needed somebody who knew what he was doing in studio wise. So we'd go there with our ideas and try and put these things together.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how Kalawa, you know, started off, you know.
So what went wrong in that partnership?
I can't necessarily say something went wrong. I always had an ambition. My ambition was always be international.
Sure.
It was always my aim. I wanted to be, let's make music for the world.
Sure.
You know, maybe with all the imports and everything. And I guess that was my vision. It wasn't necessarily the vision of the three of us. It was, let's build home, which was great. Yes, I wanted to build South African, but I wanted to take it to the world.
Yes, sir.
And maybe I was impatient. I don't know.
Sure.
And another thing that had a bit of an impact was the fact that I couldn't use the studio when I wanted to.
Ah, yes, yes.
Henceforth, I started with Pedro and doing stuff on the side. And eventually, yeah, you know, I kind of went on my own and I thought, you know what, let me do this and let me go on this journey and try and make music for South African music for the world.
Sure.
So that was my aim.
So there's no hard feelings, no love lost?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Okay.
And henceforth, I think Kalawa's name never changed. It never changed. You know, I think there was no love lost. I think it was just, it was an agreement.
So the Ka in Kalawa is your surname, Katsaitis, obviously.
Yeah.
So surely you're entitled to 1/3 of the Kalawa portion. Because your name is still there.
I think because it was mutually agreed. I think, you know, those days, your word's your word.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's what it is.
So one thing I've always appreciated about you, Chris, is the fact that not only did you open the door for yourself, but you always made sure that there were other kids learning, there were other kids developing as you were growing. You've never been selfish with the stage. You've never been, I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, I remember when the Springboks won the Rugby World Cup in 1995. I was a student. I'd been in Joburg for 4 months. Literally only 4 months. And there was a party, I think it was Dr. Kumalo, who had a party in Bryanston, and you were the DJ there. The minute you saw me, you're like, do you want to play? I mean, you literally just said, dude, do you want to jam a couple of records? And I mean, I remember digging into a record box. I was like, fuck yeah, I want to do this. And I mean, Kwaito was huge at the time. And I still remember every single track that I played at that party. And again, you didn't have to do that. But you've always been that guy.
I think from my perspective, you know, I think music is something to be shared.
Yeah.
And doing it together as a collective, you know, just is so powerful.
Sure.
You know, and one thing we needed, because we didn't have a scene,
was
for us to be together. And I think we've also reached the heights we've reached now. I think because of that, you know. And like I say, all of us that started in those days, including yourself, eventually on the way, we're still there because, you know, we saw the importance of building this industry, you know, because it's not about an individual.
In fact, one of the reasons I'm reminding you of this is because there's two gents that I met at your studio that you mentored, but I think they'll tell the story better. You'll tell us who this is.
Hi, this is Revolution. Man, honoring Christos. Where do we start? I mean, there should be a movie written about this guy.
Absolutely.
I mean, this guy is one of the guys who are the foundation of house music, you know. He has had a hand in so many people's lives. He was the guy who welcomed us, Skull Groove Records, Orange Grove. We used to hang out there. He taught us so many things about music. He would take us to gigs. You know, he's that type of father and is very brutally honest, you know. And he's the guy who taught us how to read the crowd, you know, music. I mean, so many things. And he's also a father figure, you know, and a mentor and a friend. I mean, we've met majority of the people that we now call friends now through him, from the late Iggy Smalls, DJ Monde, Advocate Terim Dau, I mean, all the guys, Bapum Shaka, so many people we've met. And another guy that I think should have been honored, same time, the Chris, is Brawili. Because for me, those two guys, you know, played a pivotal role in everything that we do as Revolution. I mean, we came in as dancers. And then from there, we went on to become DJs and then production, because he's the one of the guys who allowed us in his studio. Mm. We watched him work on all projects, and we were doing performances more for the album Elia Sekele, two DJs and a keyboard player.
As Revolution, we would like to say thank you very much for your contribution to the dance culture in South Africa, your contribution to our career, and for opening up your doors and welcoming us into your space. Thank you. If it wasn't for you, all of this and what we are today would not be possible.
I remember Revolution because I used to come and hang out at your record shop.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a time where I think my lectures were cancelled. So I walked to your store and Willie was there. So Willie's like, the youngster from Botswana, come play records, youngster. And Willie let me get on the decks and just listen to a couple of records. But there were always these twins from Alex, which I later found out that was Revolution. Tell us about your relationship with Revolution.
They used to hang out in the store and stuff like that. And they were cool, you know, and they would, you know, bop to the songs. And, you know, eventually when we were actually going out trying to promote the album, I thought, you know, let's put an outfit together. We had the singer, we'd DJ, and we'd have them as dancers.
Imagine.
You know, and yep, so they started off as dancers. And we go on the road, put on these tours, and it was fun. And they would spend endless hours in the studio with me, you know, when I was recording whatever, Boom Shaka, you know, and eventually they just blew up and it was amazing, man, you know.
Now, in terms of your ability to spot talent and nurture talent and build talent, I mean, you guys literally built Boom Shaka from scratch. I remember the first Boom Shaka gig in Botswana, I think it was 94, early 95. And it was you, obviously, and the kids. I mean, they were still kids, though. They were 15, 16 at the time. And they were very shy. You know, they were still working on the stage act. I remember Lebu and Tembi coming up to me. He's like, hey, Maluma Fresh, a cup of Coke. And I had to go get them cool drink. And I mean, take us through the journey of building what became a household brand.
Yeah, Boom Shaka was... it was phenomenal because, you know, when we're actually sitting at Kalawa and we conceptualized Boom Shaka, and Boom Shaka was never meant to be a group.
Yeah.
So the Raga era was big at the time.
Oh, yes.
So the kind of Raga house.
Yeah.
And even the slower stuff. And
thanks to Shabba Ranks amongst others. Yeah.
So like I said, when we started off, we were kind of trying to do a bit of remakes, but at the same time including original stuff.
Yeah.
So we used Junior to do the Raga stuff, and Lebo and Tembi, we'd met them at the arena.
Yeah.
And
they used to come there and dance.
Yeah. And, you know, Lebo said, let me try out the mic, you know. Picked up, of course, she's a good talent.
Yeah.
You know, and Tembi was just jumping on, you know, and she was more into the rap stuff.
So.
And we brought in Junior to do the ragga stuff. And we pulled off this album. It was kind of a compilation album.
Yeah.
And funny enough, the song called Makwere blew up, which was actually Don Laka on the vocals.
Oh, Makwere, Kwere, Kwere.
Yes, it was actually Don.
Is that Bradon on the...
That's Bradon.
Wow.
So that was Bradon, and he actually conceptualized the whole song. It was like his, let me throw this in. Yeah. And that song actually blew up and became...
It was huge.
It was massive.
Yeah.
It was massive. And then we realized...
It was nice and big and xenophobic.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the xenophobic part, but yeah, I think no ill intents, you know, I don't even know where that came from. I was actually asked Don.
In fact, you know what it was? I think it was almost just more of a, like similar to Arthur's K-word song.
Yeah.
It's not glorifying the word as much as it's affirming that don't call me that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it actually wasn't xenophobic, but, you know, for those that didn't necessarily get the context, they might have thought it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then eventually, I mean, this thing blew up. Now we had to do performances and, you know, try and get this album out because we didn't know what else to do. I mean, we had varsities.
Yeah.
We were doing events for 10,000 students.
Yeah.
So we're selling the cars from the boot of our car. I mean, the cassettes from the boot of our cars.
Mm.
So how do we maximize on this?
Sure.
And we brought everybody into the studio, scrapped the album, and actually started doing songs with the entire group.
Oh, wow.
Eventually, Lebo brought in Theo. Yeah. And funny enough, it was supposed to be Ishmael that was supposed to be in Theo's place.
Ah, okay.
And Lebo was a fighter, so she said, no.
Yeah.
I want to work with Theo.
So.
And we brought in Theo, and bang, It's About Time came out.
A group was born.
And a group was born. And so it actually came by default.
True.
And now the question was, where do we go?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go from here?
Mm.
You know, and and then, you know, I think it changed hands. We did two albums with under Kalawa.
I was going to say, because then there was that fallout where Boom Shaka had with Kalawa. And then they did work with you.
Yeah.
Did that in any way cause any animosity or any issues?
It did.
Yeah.
It did, because Boom Shaka was a massive group.
Sure.
And of course, it created tensions.
Yeah.
In the sense of events. I mean, we were new at this.
Yeah.
And we became big household names.
Yes.
So there was a tension. It was kind of, you know, who's the boss?
Yeah.
Who's this?
Mm.
You know, all those things, especially with the band. I think the animosity was not between us as individuals, but with the groups it was.
Mm.
It was, because there was a lot of competition and all around.
Sure.
We had to kind of find each other. I mean, we're starting something that we didn't know what we were doing.
Mm.
I mean, I remember when we did the album of Boom Shaka. And once again, I think from their perspective, they wanted to be where I wanted to go.
Mm.
In other words, let's break internationally.
Sure.
Or our vision was somewhere different, you know?
Mm.
And when we did the national anthem.
Yeah.
So we released the album. And here we're in this transition period, and here the national anthem. And I remember being called by 702.
Yeah.
Now I'm young.
Yeah.
I don't know how to run a record label. I don't know how to run a record company. And I get radio stations calling me, what's up with you guys? Why are you guys doing the national anthem? Your girls are half naked on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all these questions are thrown at me and I'm like, what's going on here? You know, all of a sudden we're all in all the papers.
Yeah.
You know, getting government officials calling us, you know what, when you guys perform the song, you have to be dressed up.
Yeah.
You know, and get, you know, and all these things, you know.
What did Madiba have to say about the anthem?
He said they need to be dressed when they perform. And we actually performed it with him, you know. Yeah, we did. But funny enough, you know, from the beginning they were.
Yeah.
So And for us, we felt that people don't know the national anthem.
Mm.
Let's add a vibe to it.
Sure.
And let people get into it. Yes. And we had this flag up. I guess it is what it is, but it sure. doesn't make sense. We sing it at sporting games. We have beers. We whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's your national anthem.
Absolutely.
You know, best way to get people to know it is
yeah.
put a groove to it.
But you had a special relationship with Lebo, because even when she did her solo releases, I mean, you were part of the production team, you were part of the release. Tell us about, one, the relationship with Lebo at a professional level, and exactly for you personally, what losing her meant.
I think, you know what, I got to add the personal level in as well. We started, Lebo, I was like a father figure to her.
Yeah.
And we clicked, musically we clicked.
Mm.
Lebo had, it was as if we were kind of one spirit.
Sure.
I could feel her, I could feel what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
When I made music, she'd feel it and she'd give me what I wanted out of the song, sure. you know. And we'd work tirelessly, you know, in the studio. I mean, remember, we could sit in the studio for 2-3 days
yeah.
and just go out. We go out for a shower or whatever and come back and just sit in the studio and do one track.
Wow.
One track.
Yeah.
And Lebo was a perfectionist like that. Nah, yeah. breathe wrong. Mm. I'm going to redo it. And I was like, come on.
Yeah.
I'll take out the breathing. No, I don't want you to take out the breathing. I want to hear my breathing. She used to drive me mad. But either way, she was a perfectionist like that. And she really had big ambitions, you know. And but I think besides that, you know, we just were very close. And I was a father figure to her, you know. And, well, she released the album when she went solo. I only did 2 tracks.
Yeah.
Which were the 2 big tracks off that specific album.
Which are still playing on radio now.
Yeah, she wanted to take another direction, which I was cool with, and I advised her. I think it's good.
Sure.
And, you know, either way, it's a solo career. You need to have something broader to go on.
Sure.
And whenever she was in trouble, Lebo would end up staying by me, you know.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of relationship.
Mm.
I think losing her, it distraught me, you know, because We were busy working on an album. Mm. She was about to explode internationally.
Sure.
She was planning a show with a band that she was going to take all over the world.
Wow.
And we were planning on how we're going to, you know, do this whole, we had so many tracks done, you know.
Yeah.
And, but it's not about the tracks that were done. And henceforth, I never took anything out.
Mm.
For me, it was just that, you know what? Wow. What a talent. What a beautiful soul.
Mm.
You know, everything, you know, stopped in a certain sense, you know.
So are you saying we'll never hear the stuff you guys were working on?
You know what? I didn't have much. I've got a couple of the lyrics. I had a lot of the music.
Mm.
A lot of the music was done. We threw in some ideas.
Yeah.
But I decided, you know what? I'm not going to be one of those. I know a lot of the record companies jump in and when somebody passes away and do this and do that.
Yeah.
And she was tied down to a record label at the time.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, no, I ain't going to do that. Mm. I was asked a lot of things.
Yeah.
I said, I ain't going to do that. You know what I mean? For me, it was just personal, you know.
Mm.
It was just very personal. There was a lot of things also going on with a career, not only a career, sorry, a estate, and a lot of things that never made sense to me because, you know, I literally lived 15 or 20 years with Lebo.
Mm.
We'd see each other all the time.
Mm.
I knew a lot about her life, you know, and a lot of the things that were in the media or whatever happened, I never experienced in the sense of how it was sensationalized, you know.
What did you think of the mini series they did on her life?
You know, definitely not Lebo, you know. I think once again, too much sensationalism. It's like you try and sell the sensationalism and you don't sell the reality.
Yeah, the person.
You know, the person. Mm. You know, and that was it. I said it. Unfortunately, you know, they didn't listen.
Yeah.
You know.
Speaking of you and relationships, I've got another voice note for you.
Yo, what's up? This is Vinny Da Vinci. Now, as we honor the legendary DJ Christos, to me, he's a friend. An all-round good guy. And I'd like to say he's the DJ's DJ.
Absolutely.
I fully got into the DJ world after watching and listening to his sets back in the late 80s. I then told myself, this is it. This is what I want to do. Mm. DJ Christos is passionate about the craft. That's why he has a DJ academy, mentoring and giving master classes about the DJ world. He loves the music, especially house music. Mm. His track selection is out of this world.
Yeah.
And he mixes in key.
Dude.
I'd like to wish him and his family more life. May God grant him more blessings, peace, and cheers.
Vinny Da Vinci. You know what the weird thing is? And I always tell the story. How I met Oskido in 92, and I was a fan. I met you in 93, I was a fan. I met Vinny in 94, I was a fan. Little did I know again that one day we'd be in the same rooms, let alone running a company together, doing conferences together. So for me, you guys are like the three pillars that I looked up to when I was coming up. Mm-hmm. That if I can just have half that talent, even if I just have 1/8 of Christos's mixing and track selection, if I can just have even just a quarter of Vinny and Oskido's humility, then my career will be fine. So I'd actually like to thank you guys, because you guys mentored me at a time where mentorship wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
Mentorship for me is watch how people do things and emulate the things that work for you. A lot of kids think mentorship is take my hand.
Yeah.
Go show me a mixer. Mentorship is, okay, I'm going to go to a Christos gig and listen to the mixing, listen to how technical he is. That is also mentorship. So definitely. I want to thank you and Vinny and Oskido, because like I said, I met you guys literally 3 years in a row, and little did I know that one day we'd be breaking bread together.
Yeah.
Tell us about you and Vinny.
I actually met Vinny in Cherries.
Yeah.
And I'd done a project called Vision at the time.
Okay.
And
I remember the Vision project.
Yeah.
I think I still have a Vision vinyl, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was an amazing project. I mean, that's the first time I got into studio and started doing what I loved.
Yeah.
You know, and funny enough, that was before Kalawa.
Yeah.
And that's where I kind of got hooked on studio because...
Because this is pre-Kwaito.
This is pre-Kwaito. This is...
Madiba is out, but we don't know where the country is going yet. But there is a euphoria, niceness.
Yes.
And the music is changing.
So once again, we did a couple of covers.
Yeah.
On that album. And then we did original stuff. Funny enough, one of the tracks was with Maria Makeba's son.
Yeah.
And
Nelson Lee. Yes.
You know,
remember that project.
And that became massive.
What is it? Mystery Girl.
Mystery Girl.
Yes.
And that was kind of at the back of the Frankie Knuckles era, David Morales, which had such an impact in our country, you know. That whole scene, that mid-tempo.
Mid-tempo house with the chunky bass lines, the nice chords.
And that album was kind of a celebration of that. And we did our own renditions of certain songs, a song called Laid Back and Groovy.
Oh, yes.
And like I said, stuff we couldn't release. But we did original stuff on that album. And, you know, that's where I felt I'm definitely going to get into studio, you know, at some time.
Yeah.
And do what I want to do, but I need to learn first.
Sure.
And I was actually promoting that album. We pressed the vinyl.
Mm.
And Vinny was... I went to the clubs and I met Vinny at Cherries.
Yeah.
That's when I invited him to Caesars.
Sure.
And that's when Vinny brought the whole of Pretoria, and then I got fired from Caesars.
Because, like, why are there so many blacks all of a sudden?
Yep. Yeah. So I was like given an ultimatum, and I took it. I said, bye.
Yeah.
See you later, mate. I'm out of here. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I kind of met Vinny there, and we remained friends, and he eventually worked in the record store.
Mm.
He was also in the record store with me.
Yeah.
And our careers grew, and, when we had the studio, eventually when I built the studio and I was busy with Boom Shaka,
yeah.
I mean, it was a good time for us, and I said, Vinny, let's go and make music.
Sure.
Let's go and make music. I mean...
Is that how DJs at Work was
born? That's how DJs at Work was born. And, we did a DJ album,
yeah.
You know, and once again used the samples, but we did the music. A lot of the music was original.
Sure.
And bang, a massive album.
I remember you guys did the album launch in the Val.
Yes.
And every ticket came with a cassette.
Yeah.
I think you guys moved gold. You moved 20,000 yes. cassettes at that venue at alone.
Gold in one day from a gig. Gold from a gig. And thank God, you know, we had the budget because of Boom Shaka and everything moving.
Yeah.
So we could actually print those tapes and we went gold on the day. And, you know, can just imagine everybody leaving the venue playing
with the
album.
Brand new album.
What happened? I mean, that just, that album went to, I think, 120,000 sales.
Yo. So it was like there was no more platinum at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, there was no more platinums left. You know, so it was a massive album. And yeah, man. And I think besides that, just our relationship continued. We did four albums together, you know, with Vinny as DJs at work.
Yes.
And the fifth one is in the pipeline. It's going to come somewhere along the way.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you and Vinny's longevity, I think, is something the research papers should be done on. Because, I mean, you guys have been at this since the late 80s.
Yeah.
And you guys are still performing at this level in 2024. And what I love is the fact that you guys operate in your own lanes. You're not trying to be number one. You're not, you're just carrying on with your consistency. Because often it's your consistency that will carry you in your career. Can we talk about that for a second? Are you guys intentional about it? Is it just God's grace?
I think in a sense it's God's grace, but I think we're on the same level of understanding. Maybe it's the time that we grew up. Maybe it's the circumstances that we grew up on in, within the industry, in the sense that we knew when we started off, it was always a search for that song.
Yes.
And that has never ended, even for me. Today, it's the search for that song. One song and a gig can make the gig, absolutely. If you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people don't actually see that. I mean, I see a lot of the young guys that are coming. It's, if I can play this hit.
Yeah.
For us, it's the opposite. If we can play a track that nobody knows and everybody can sing to it or scream at it and we can break it, that is the ultimate DJing experience. And that's what we lived by, and we both know that, and we've seen the what it does.
And I think your fans probably go to your gigs looking for that.
Yes.
I wonder what track Chris is going to play today that I've never heard before. But I didn't even know I needed to hear it.
That's it. And you know what? And I think it's a timing thing to play that song at the right moment.
Yes.
At the right time.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't always get it right, but you know what? You strive to it.
Yes, sir.
You strive to it. And I think that for us, it's always been, let's go to the next level. Absolutely. You know, let's go to the future.
Yes, sir.
So I think because we never look back. Yes, we love the classics and all those. But we always look for the next thing.
Absolutely.
And that is kind of our trick. And I don't know if it's a trick, but that's kind of what's in our hearts. It's the next thing, you know. So we kind of stay right up to date to where we're at, you know.
Sure. Now, speaking of relationships, there's another guy here. I met this dude through you. I think probably in the early 2000s. In fact, I met a ton of people in this industry through you in the late 90s, early 2000s. There's this dude here.
Good morning, Ima, and also for Fresh, and congratulations on your new podcast. And then I want to also say thank you for sending me this message to honor Chris and his fond memories. And my name is Aubrey Lowe from Istres. I grew up in Istres.
I've never known his surname.
And how I got to meet Chris was in my down days in 2003, 2004. And the impact he had on my life and also with events. And when Chris was a DJ. And then my first event that I hosted in 2003, 2004 is still... The name is still there. The brand is still there in Istres. And it was my first all-white party that I hosted in Istres. And Chris came. I booked Chris for that event. And Chris just made miracles for me that day. And I think what I've learned from him as a brother is basically his relationship with God, his covenant with God, and the impact he had on other people who became DJs as well today, who are today well-established DJs. I remember the first person who comes to my mind, it's Black Coffee. When I met Chris, Chris was managing Black Coffee. Mm-hmm. And then he told me that we need to promote our brother. And then and I know we went to a lot of functions or gigs. And then Black Coffee was there. And we were trying to promote Black Coffee. And if you see where Black Coffee is today, Black Coffee is a recognized international DJ. And I think that information is not known, that Chris played a very huge role in where Black Coffee is today. Chris believes in building legacy and grooming other people. And he has groomed a lot of DJs mm-hmm. who are today well-known DJs. Mm-hmm. The Late Monday. I met so many DJs through Chris. And then also the DJ U, the company of Vinny Fresh or Skido, Greg, and I think the last one is Glenn Lewis. And then we used to host a lot of functions. I used to assist them a lot when they host functions. I remember the function that we used to host in Swaziland every year on the 31st, huge parties. And the fond memories I've learned about Chris is the golden heart that he has, a giving heart. And always when you go and you have a problem or you have an emergency, Chris is always there to assist you. Mm. And he never asks you for money. Or when I say, Chris, I've got a function, I've got a party, he comes and he plays for you. And when he has a relationship with you, the brotherly relationship with you, he will always just keep quiet and walk away. He'll never phone and say, brother,
where's my money?
I played at your function. Where's my money? No. He's always there when you're in trouble. And then that's my takeaway from Chris.
Aubrey. I met Aubrey through you. In fact, Aubrey has booked me in Easterust quite a while. But the reason I asked Aubrey for a voice note is because uh-huh. what I've noticed also about you is you build relationships even with promoters, even with venues. And yeah. that's probably one of the reasons why there's places that have booked you nonstop for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I think it's important to build relationships. You know, for me, a performance... And you want to go somewhere, you want to please the crowd, everything. You know, people are coming for you. I mean, we are names now where people come for us.
Absolutely.
And, you know, no matter how good or bad it is, you got to make the best out of it, you know. But I think relationships are very important. And I think from the club owners, especially the ones that are passionate about what they do, they can see that passion. I think the timing, yes. helping them out, some of them also just guiding them, you know, just for especially being in the industry for a long time, you know. And I think it all comes and it kind of pays itself back. I didn't necessarily do it for that, but I think it's important that you have those relationships. I mean, it's important for me when you build people, how do you get them into the club scene? I had that relationship. So I have that relationship where I can place people in certain venues, you know, and people that would have an impact in those venues, you know.
So.
And so for me, it's always been there. And relationships is it's what makes our industry tick, you know.
There's another dude that you have a long-term relationship with. So I remember about 91, 92, as I'm starting in radio, there's a dude I used to listen to on Radio Bop doing breakfast. And he had a fire breakfast show. Easily one of the hottest breakfast shows I've heard, especially back then. And little did I know that I'd also develop a relationship with the said guy. But he's got a long-term relationship with you also. And he sent us this.
Yo, how's everybody? What's up, Fresh? What's up, Christos? What is there to share about Christos that the people don't know about? Crazy individual, loves his job. He's got a good heart. one thing that I remember about Christos is that when I was still in Mafikeng, all the guys would come to my house because my house was the most comfortable place.
Party
Central. And I remember we woke up one morning and Christos says, Glenn, let's go and buy food. So here we are. We wake up. We go to Mafikeng town to buy food. Guys, I didn't see any food. All I saw was cakes. Christos bought crisps. Christos bought chips. Christos bought chocolate. None of the stuff that we bought that day had anything to do with groceries. You know, when you talk groceries, you talk about meat, you talk about bread, etc., etc. But yeah, we basically just came back with junk food as if we were kids going on a picnic. So this particular story, I've never shared it with anyone, but whenever I see Christos, I basically go back to that day in Mafikeng about 25 years ago. And all the best to you, Christos. You're one of the best. Peace.
Glenn Lewis, again, consistency, passion, delivering over and above all the time. That's probably why he's been doing this for 30 years plus, and he's still doing it. Talk to us about your relationship with, one, with Glenn Lewis and with Mafikeng and Buputa Tswana at the time.
Hey, man, it is, Mafikeng was on fire, you know. It was one of the our key areas, you know, at the time, and you know, people loved traveling, and Mafikeng was just one of those places, and also the people from there, you know. There was just so much talent, there was just so much happening there. And I met Glenn, and I actually remember that day. I think we set up the turntables on his stove, you know, so how did he expect us to cook food? There wasn't enough space, so we actually, he had quite a big stove. So I put the two turntables, obviously the stove was off.
So this is at the
mixer.
The Bop Broadcasting flats.
Yes, at the flats.
Yeah.
So I remember having, and we were playing music the whole day, you know, having shots, having drinks.
Yeah.
Glenn wouldn't drink. He was never a drinker. And, well, as far as I know, he doesn't drink. But, and we're just playing music, man. You know, just having fun being DJs.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's what it's all about. And he started obviously supporting the record store. And one thing with Glenn, he's just got an amazing ear for music, man.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I think that's Glenn's trump card, you know, just being able to pick hits or pick specific tracks that you'd never even, you'd walk right past them in a certain sense.
You know that there are songs that Glenn would play at gigs where we play together where no one would dance. Like, no one would dance. But Glenn would play the whole song.
Yeah.
3 months later, same song is playing, and people are losing their minds. I'm like, guys, Glenn played you this 3 months ago. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's Glenn. That's Glenn, you know.
And I appreciate that about him, that he sticks to his guns.
Yep.
That if he thinks you need to hear the song, he will play it. Yeah. Whether or not you dance, you will hear the song.
He knows he had a special ear. I mean, Glenn took a long time to learn how to mix.
Yeah.
But Glenn was always booked.
Sure.
And his music choice, you know, I actually say that to my students sometimes, you know, that, you know what, music is the core foundation of DJing. It's 80% music and the 20% is the technical side.
Absolutely.
You know, it's kind of the cherry on the top. But if you don't have the musical ability to be able to choose songs,
yes,
you can't do this.
Exactly.
You know?
You're talking about your students, and I mean, you've got a DJ academy. Some might or might not know this. Tell us about this academy. Who are you targeting, and when do you take people into the academy?
Started the academy, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Something I've always wanted to do. Sure. I think COVID allowed me that space, even though I started just after COVID. But it allowed me the space to, let's do this eventually.
Yeah.
And it was to the academy. I actually take people through the journey of my career, but I've kind of squashed it and put it into a program. And a lot of people call me that know how to DJ, but they say, look, man, I want to go to the next level.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, my program is for everyone, a beginner or even if you've been in the industry forever, because it's built in such a way that it's like beginning to end.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's the business, it's everything, but also the technical stuff, the musical side.
So it's not a mixing course.
No.
It's everything you need to know about.
DJing, everything you need to know about
DJing. Of DJing.
Yes.
Ah.
So people get there on the first day and they look at me and this guy's bringing out books.
Yeah.
And he's got a book. What's going on here? And I'm talking about the history of house,
yeah,
where we started, and then get into the, you know, the DJ stuff, but go into how music is made.
Sure.
You know, so that they understand in the beat format and that dance music is the same. It doesn't matter. You know, and a lot of the dance music came out of house.
Sure.
You know, eventually, and where it came from and just the story behind it, but also how it's made so they understand. And also make them understand the importance of, because this is how you put music. And what I do is, the mixing side is easy because I've got a good program, especially with digital, and I'm not saying people are syncing.
Sure.
But it's easy to teach somebody to get the beats. Yeah. I can do that within two or three sessions.
Sure.
What we focus on majority is actually to actually put sets together and put music together.
Ah.
And that's where I focus the emphasis so that somebody can think when he's playing, what do I play? And you put various sets. So you're doing a 6 o'clock set here today. Put the set together for me.
Mm.
You're doing a peak hour set at such a venue. Now you're at a festival.
Okay, so they even do practical scenarios.
Practical scenarios. So you do it. So it's kind of a mock of where would you go once you learn how to mix. And that's where you go.
Yeah.
So that you actually have an understanding. How do I put things together?
Sure.
And putting sets together.
What's my role at which event? At what time?
Yes. Where do I buy my music? How do I buy my music?
Sure.
How do I file it? How do I put it together? When I'm at event, how do I file? Because as much as at the end of the day, let's be honest, we play house, but
sure,
then there's categories of house.
Sure.
So
sure,
where do I file all my stuff?
Mm.
So if I'm in a niche venue, I could play the niche stuff.
Sure.
If I'm in this type of a venue, I could play more hype stuff, you know, whatever it is, you know, and teach them how to be a DJ, because
sure,
I think that's what it's all about. Then at the end of the day as well, how do I make money out of this? And how do I keep those relationships? How do I, my timing, how do I hustle,
sure,
you know?
So how do we enroll to your DJ Academy?
Online. Mm. It's DJ Christos Music Academy. So you contact us and basically we run programs 4 times a year.
Okay.
And
so how long is this course?
I normally spread it out in 3 months because it's a 10-week if you do a Saturday.
Okay.
It's a full month if you do full-time.
Okay.
And it's a 6-week if you do evening classes.
Okay, so how many hours am I needed for each class?
At least 2.
Okay.
So it's about 20, but in all fairness, when you start counting it with all the extra, you're doing about 30, 40 hours.
Okay.
And it's serious 30, 40 hours of training in a certain sense because the minute you get in, you get to the task, you know.
Absolutely.
And you get this book. We go through a lot of things. A lot of guys don't write in the book. The guys that don't write in the book, because I don't have a book where I explain everything. I have a book with a caption.
Sure.
And it's a heading.
Sure.
And then I sit and explain the story and I tell you, write down what is important, what you feel is important.
Yes,
so
yes,
write down. Yes. Have it in your own words. Keep this book. It's nice and graphic. It's like a kid's book.
It's like a coloring book.
Yes, it's like a coloring book, but I want you to be part of it.
Ah, yes.
You know, so write your story. And I always tell people, you'll never throw this book away because it's actually the A to Z in your career.
Mm.
There's most of these things, if not all these things, you're going to go through.
Sure.
And you know, you might not go through them now, but you're going to go through it later. I even go to the point of when something trips in the DJ box, what do you do?
Ah.
Because we're alone in the DJ box and things happen.
Sure.
If a CD player switches off, what do you do? You know, even going to things like that.
I've never thought about it. What do you do?
Exactly. How do you get it back on? Have a bit of a knowledge of your equipment. How do they connect to each other?
Sure.
I mean, there's certain things we can do. If the monitor is giving you a problem, you could fix it or tell the guy what to do.
Sure.
When you put on your headphones, are you checking that both channels are playing and that the RCAs are working?
Yeah.
Because a lot of guys, I mean, I played with some people, and I'm not going to mention names because I don't, you know, but I was playing with DJs that have been playing for a long time. They were saying, you know, the one side's louder than the other. And I said, I heard that. When I got there, immediately when I put on my headphones, because they're stereo, I could hear the one side wasn't playing.
Sure.
So the RCA was not put in properly, and I just pushed it back in and problem sorted. But I mean, a simple thing like that.
And I think one thing a lot of DJs take for granted is the fact that you're also a sound engineer. You're not just a disc spinner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's important that, for instance, your music is going out at the same dBs, for instance.
Yeah.
Just little things like that.
Importantly, in the school, I mean, the first thing they do at the school, funny enough,
yeah,
don't touch the red.
Yeah.
And how do you get a peak performance without touching the red?
Absolutely.
With different scenarios.
Mm.
Sorry. And how do you get the level to be perfect?
Sure.
Because I teach them the first thing is, if there's a certain power that's going on on the dance floor,
sure,
and when you lose that power because your one song is lower, louder than the other, you lose the floor.
Sure.
Forget the song. So for you to be able to play what you want to play, sure, you got to keep that power.
Absolutely.
So that's step one.
Mm.
Then we get into the mix.
Sure.
And then how do you mix? But most importantly, if you've got the right song and you've got the power, you can play.
Absolutely.
We'll get to the technical stuff later.
Is your course affordable?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is for the knowledge that we impart.
Sure.
You know? Yes, it is. And we do sponsor people.
Ah, okay. So you also have like a bursary program of sorts.
You know what? I choose people sometimes. Well, I think we've had a lot of people, sometimes difficult with certain people. I try and take care of those that are closer because it makes it a little bit easier.
Sure.
So it's a bit of both. And if I see talent, I try to get them in. You know?
We have another word for you.
This is so cool. You know, when you get a chance to speak about people or a person who you knew before they knew you, who you idolized before they knew you, and who you met and you just felt like, wow, this is a dream come true. That's what I think of Christos, DJ Christos. I mean, my first live, the first time I saw him live was in 1999 in Bloemfontein at a club called L'Afrique.
Your L'Afrique
for an event that Channel O did, the House Explosion. They were launching the actual album. And like it's a moment that has been imprinted in my mind throughout my days of being in house music and being active in house music. I mean, we can call Christos the person who began it all, who made us all see that it's actually here and it's living, and we are going to do this for the longest time. Obviously, my fondest memory of him, and I probably tell him as well, is when he had the ponytail. There was something so magical about that ponytail when he was DJ. I don't know what it was, but it was just charismatic, and it was just also him, like with the charismatic movements while he was DJing. I mean, from then until I actually got to meet him after I got into the industry, and I just met like the greatest, most supportive person ever for anyone in the industry. You didn't have to be his friend, but if he had, if you needed some sort of advice or whatever, you could literally walk up to Christos and he'll give you good advice, but in simplicity. He always had a way of simplifying things.
That's Lulo Cafe, because I know he holds you in very high regard. In fact, myself and Lulo often talk about how, you know, if we had the Christos miles behind us in our careers, we'd be full of shit. And we don't understand how you're not full of shit, because we'd be full of shit. Yeah, but listen, Lulo like truly looks up to you. Yeah. So he, like I said, I had to just get a word from Lulo. Another person that's had an incredible relationship with you. Oh yeah, we're almost done, by the way. Apparently we're running out of time. Are we out of time? 1 hour is nothing, guys. Here's another dude that I met through you. Okay, let me start again.
Is it fresh? I am sorry. I have just been too hectic on my side. Apologies. I don't know if it's going to be too late. But anyway, you know, one thing that I can remember very well is that back in the days, Christos used to live in Brooklyn. He used to stay in an apartment behind the house. We used to share vinyls. I used to meet Christos on the side of the road and literally take vinyls from him. And he was such a cool guy, very, very easy guy that you could get music from. You know, sometimes you needed to have a specific song. You just didn't have the bucks to buy the vinyls. But Christos was that guy that you could go and take from his collection, but you had to give it back the very next day. And he had this distinct markings on his vinyls. I can't recall if it was either the key or if it was the BPM, but I remember he used to have a label on his on all his vinyls. There was a place that we played in Marula San, close to Marula San, back in the days. He would know the name. I just forgot the name now. It's just off my tongue. But it was the most popular venue in Pretoria, not very far from Marula San. Christos will probably tell you what the name is. Those years, it was Vinny Da Vinci. There's a guy called Positive K, Kalabi, that's what we called him. Cory the Groove.
He's all legends.
Who else was part of that? It was a whole bunch. I think Bob Mabena was also part of that. There was another guy from Radio Bob at the time. I know he's late right now. I just forgot his name.
Aldrin.
Aldrin Mohotsi.
I think his surname could be Mohotsi. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Aldrin Mohotsi.
But it's Blast from the Past. I just remember the fond memories that I had was Christos was at Mega Tracks at that time.
That's Jazzy D. Tell us quickly your relationship with Jazzy D.
Just met him through the scene, you know, and a great guy, you know, just had a vision and he's still doing well for himself, you know. He's found his niche.
He's found his niche, his pop niche.
His pop niche and, you know, wherever he goes, wherever he wants to. I appreciate people like that, you know. I always say to people, you know what, sometimes people feel like I may be too harsh on this. I may be too harsh on my industry or what I believe in.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I always say to people, find your niche.
Absolutely.
I say that even to my students, you know, find your niche. I don't care what you play. We don't teach deep house at my school.
Yeah.
I teach you to play music. I ask you, what do you play?
Sure.
Let's build you on what you play and what you love.
If you want to play jazz, go find
play
that
it.
Niche.
Play
absolutely.
It, man.
Absolutely. Okay. We have one more before we... we let you go. And the reason I want to play this one is because this is probably one of your biggest products out there.
Man, when it comes to Christos, I wouldn't even know where to begin. I know him as one of the most like selfless people that I know. And this is outside just music. You know, just as a human being, I watched him navigate life in front of me with family. I learned like a lot from him. This is back in the day, you know, when he was assisting us, and I saw him interact with people. Just in general, we'll be in a petrol station filling up petrol, and I would watch him like deal with people. We get to a gig, I would watch him deal with the promoter. I would watch him deal with the fans. You know, when we get to the gigs, like I learned so much from him. You know, and he just by example, he taught me so much without even saying a word. You know, and he's just such a given human being. You know, sometimes when we speak about people, we want to speak about their work, and I just want to speak about him outside that. It's just him as a human being, you know. He's done so much for so many people, you know, myself included, and many others, you know, in and outside of the scene, you know. He's a brother to me, you know. He's someone I truly, truly love and admire. You know, he really helped me create roots of humility, you know, in the industry, just learning on how to be a human being, man. Thank you for everything, Chris, man. We love you. You know this. God bless you, my brother.
When you look at the heights at which Black Coffee is at right now, and you look at how you helped them, as in Shana and Nati and who else? Shoba, who are the others?
Demore.
Oh, yes, Demore, yes. Looking at Black Coffee's meteoric ascent, like, what goes through your mind? What do you feel?
I think that was my... It's something that I believed we could achieve for me when I go back in that day and said, I wanted to leave Kalawa because this is where I wanted to be.
Sure.
That was the dream.
Sure.
It was, and I think Coffee lived the dream because the dream was not necessarily for me.
Sure.
I don't think I could achieve it at the time.
It was for our music to get to that level.
100%.
Yes.
So for me, it was, this is where we want to be. Well, this is the beginning of where we want to be, you know.
Absolutely.
Where we wanted to go, you know. And I think that was it. And, you know, I was just really blessed to be with so much talent. I mean, with Lebu and Coffee, these people were highly talented.
Mm.
You know, and trying to figure out what to do with them. How do you grow their careers?
Sure.
How do you build them as people?
Yeah.
Because it's very, very important because the career is one, but build them as people. Because if you're strong as a person, then you can handle anything.
You can stand the test.
You know, so it was, you need to build people.
Sure.
I think, and that was important. And there were immense talents. I mean, you know, there was a lot of times I would sit and think, what am I going to do with Coffee? Coffee just kept growing.
Sure.
You know, and wow, you know, I can't say I never expected. With Coffee, everything is unexpected.
Sure.
I believe he'll even go to bigger heights than what he is at the moment, you know.
I don't think he's done. I don't think he's done at all.
Not at all.
Yeah.
He's just begun.
Absolutely. Chris, I invited you to the podcast because, like I said, I'm going to intentionally start inviting people that had a role to play in my journey, on my journey, people that influenced me positively, people that reminded me when I was a teenager that if you stay the course and you focus and you stay driven and you're consistent, there's nothing that you can't do. And you are one of those guys, my dude. That's why I wanted to bring you in here so that we can honor you, we can thank you, and then we can remind you who the hell you are. Because like I said, me and Lulo, one day when we're Christos famous, people are in trouble.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. And thank you for everything, Chris. We love you. We appreciate you. And we'll continue finding you wherever. I come to Saint every Wednesday because I know that's the only time I can get to hear you play. Because on weekends, we're both busy.
Yeah.
So every Wednesday, I'm at Saint for you and for Vinny. So thanks for keeping the music alive and for all that you've done for the scene. I think the scene would not be half of what it is were it not for your inputs and your drive and your vision. So thank you, Chris.
My pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen, as one bouncer called him in Miami, are you Steven Seagal, motherfucker? Because of the ponytail. That trip was wild, though.
Yeah, no, we don't want to talk about that.
And then we go back to the same club, and then the bouncer's like, Steven Seagal, you're back. Oh, man. Ladies and gentlemen, Steven Seagal is about to leave the building. Ladies and gentlemen, Christos Katsaitis. Thank you and shout out to DJ Christos for taking time to come and share his story and to accept the flowers that we decided to give him today. Coming up soon will be part two of Legends That Shaped My DJ Career series. We've been coming to you live from AMP Studios, downtown Johannesburg. We're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Email us at waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Shout out Trevor and his team out at Pezulu Works. They do all of the cinematography. They make us look good. They could make you look good. So look them up. Pezulu Works with an X, not a KS. Pezulu Works. Also, shout out to our image dude. His name is Otis the Flow Fraser. If you're looking for imaging for your podcast, for your radio show, for your radio station, look up Otis the Flow Fraser. And shout out to our mother, Our executive producer, Keletso Modisa-King. Till next week, have a fresh week in spite of yourselves.